Greetings, friends. Welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the film review podcast where we review movies.
That's what we do.
It's a film review podcast. We review films. My name is Whitney Seibold. I am a film critic of no renown whatsoever. And with me, as always, is a much more renowned film critic.
Yes, my name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs. And I like to review films with a mystery person. Yeah, he has no renown whatsoever. He could be anybody. He could be John Cusack.
I did just say my name, however, so I kind of gave the game away.
That could be your alias.
Oh. Hello, my name is actor John Cusack. My first name is actor.
Parents really calling your shots when they actor.
I love John Cusack, but one of my worst interview experiences was with John Cusack.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, and this is not because, you know, anything awkward. He didn't do anything awful. Just, it was for his film The Raven.
Oh, yeah.
He had spent all day on the phone with reporters, and they said, the publicist kept calling me saying, well, stand by, we might have a slot for you, and then they said they wouldn't. So I said, oh, too bad, I'll have to tell my editor I just can't. His schedule is full. I can't talk to him today.
Shit happens.
And then, like, at 5:30, they called back and they said, you know what? He's agreed to do one more. So it was the end of a long day for him.
Yeah.
And he's going to talk to one more reporter. He didn't want to do it.
Just no energy.
He wasn't there. He had answered the same question 100 uh-huh. times. Whatever I was going to say, it wasn't going to impress him. So he wasn't there. He's just not engaging in a way. It's like I'm trying to engage with him all, but he just wasn't there for me.
You know, publicity, I'm just going to say it right now, it's a hard gig. Is it like painful? No, but is it just grueling and mind-numbing and you're answering the same questions over and over again and it's bound to take its toll after 12 hours?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
it happens. I've been on both ends.
I have no ill will towards John Cusack at all for being a little bit snippy and giving me short answers during an interview, because he clearly didn't want to do it, and I was fit in at the last minute. So I was an inconvenience for him.
Yeah.
And I can appreciate that view.
Yeah. But you know what?
Have you ever been asked to stay late at your job?
I have. But you know what? I'm going to give John Cusack credit here. Mm. Here's a guy who was like, oh, someone needs the gig.
Yeah,
you know, so I don't want to. Someone got let down because of the schedule, and this way they'll have something to publish. You know, that's professional. I mean, he did the best he could. I mean, that's not so bad.
Yeah, he clearly wasn't in the mood, but yes, professional enough to actually speak to me.
Yeah.
So compliments to John Cusack, even though it was a bad interview experience for me.
So this is our John Cusack fan show.
There are no John Cusack movies this week.
That I know of.
What are we reviewing?
Instead of John Cusack movies, we are reviewing the new releases Scream! For the 2022 version, not the Wes Craven one. We're reviewing Hotel Transylvania 4, Transformania. And Mamoru Hosoda's Belle. So that's two animated films and a slasher sequel.
Mm.
That's kind of fun. It's a different ratio than usual.
we don't usually have a majority of animated features. And there's another animated film that we just didn't get to on Netflix this week.
Yeah, so, it looks really, really good. It's a stop-motion film, I think, called The House. We wanted to get to it. Didn't have the time, unfortunately. It's not a matter of making it, a matter of having it.
Which of these films do you want to talk about first?
Let's talk about the elephant in a slasher movie mask in the room. And let's talk about the brand new Scream movie.
It's not called Scream 5.
Nope.
It's called Scream.
There's a reason for that.
Which they address in dialogue. This is a requel. That is, it's staged as a remake, but it has legacy characters, so it works both as a sequel and as a remake.
So basically,
so they can sucker in two audiences simultaneously.
The format, there's two basic movies that are kind of create the framework on which the new Scream is set. One of which is rather obvious. It's David Gordon Green's Halloween. It's flat out called Halloween. And while this new Scream doesn't ignore the other sequels, it's really not about the other sequels either. It's basically a follow-up in a lot of ways to the original. Also the other film that this takes a lot of its cues from is Star Wars The Force Awakens. Because we're introducing a whole bunch of new characters, and they're going to be ushered into familiar roles to people who are familiar with the franchise by the legacy characters who will return.
When Star Wars The Force Awakens came out, I did notice some parallels between that and Tiny Toon Adventures. So this is not a new idea.
No, of course
not. We have sort of these young distaff counterpart versions of the same characters. They're really similar, but the characters also exist in that universe and they can interact.
Yeah.
That's Tiny Toons.
Yeah. Scream has always been commenting directly on whatever is happening or has happened in the horror franchise since the beginning.
The sequels less so, but first movie for sure.
I think it's interesting, actually. The original Scream came out in 1996. It was from director Wes Craven and writer Kevin Williamson. And it was a slasher movie at a time when slasher movies were not making money. When Wes Craven was not making money, his movies were not successful. It came from a no-name writer, and it featured a cast of young people knew. Drew Barrymore was in it. Courtney Cox was in it. These were celebrities.
They were the bigger names of the cast. And you know, other actors that you had seen in movies before, like Neve Campbell was on Party of Five.
Yeah.
Rose McGowan was in like The Doom Generation.
I'm pretty sure I'd already seen David Arquette before, although I'm struggling to remember what.
Yeah, I'm sure he was around.
I feel like I'd known him from something else, but in any case, this is what became his star-making role.
The gimmick with the first Scream, this is all pretty well known, is that it's a slasher movie made by Wes Craven about characters who are really familiar with slasher movies, so they recognize when they're kind of in a horror movie type scenario, and as such, talk about it in such a way. One of the characters, Randy, played by Jamie Kennedy, he's the movie obsessive. He's the horror movie obsessive. And he's the one who points out that, you know, there's so many cliches about these movies that we actually have to be cautious in the way we behave because we're kind of in a movie right now. So we have to watch the way we behave.
And plus the killers seem to know all about movies as well. And so they seem to be, it's basically the whole Scream franchise is about people who take horror movies so seriously that they decide to create them for themselves. The original film is really great. It's got a really, really great cast. It's got a smart screenplay. All the characters are like fully developed, interesting people. It works as a slasher movie. It works as a slasher commentary. It works as a comedy. And it was very, very topical. In the mid-90s, there was a lot of conversation with the MPAA, and they were talking in front of Congress about how, are violent movies making people more violent? Yeah, this was a serious concern. This was very on-the-nose consideration that was talked about openly in the movie Scream.
It's been a lot. It's been talked about, you know, ad infinitum, and it constantly comes up in, you know, censorship and media conversations. But it was really, really hip at the time in 1996 to have these conversations. Just a few years earlier, I think it was Tipper Gore who was putting warnings on records because of foul language.
This was around the time they started putting rating systems on TV shows. They never used to have them before. Mm. Yeah.
TV shows were just TV, and if they had...
they're on TV, they must be fine.
And if they had rough content, well, that's late at night. That's after the kids are in bed.
Yeah.
It's like after 10 p.m., you can put up some slightly naughtier language.
I have been turned away by, when I was young, a couple of movie theaters are trying to get into an R-rated movie without my parents. Nothing horrible. Just like, can I see American Pie? And they're like, no. And I'm like, okay, never mind. And then that was that. It happened like two or three times. At no point was I ever like watching something with my parents on the TV. And it's like the following program has been rated MA, and my parents were like, "Oh no, that never fucking happened." Because it was still TV. There was still only so much you're allowed to do.
Technically, you're allowed to do whatever the heck you want on TV. It's and the Federal Communications Commission, which is not an elected body and has no real legal recourse on anything. It just makes recommendations. There's no real law.
Well, they can fine you, but
they can't arrest you.
Yeah, they can't charge you with anything if you don't pay the fine.
You could broadcast a snuff film if you want. You're not going to go to have a snuff film, you're going to go to jail.
That's we saw Videodrome. It doesn't go well.
That was a big part of the conversation. It was such a big hit that they rushed a sequel into production. Scream 2 came out the following year.
Less than a year later, actually. It's quite good.
It's certainly good for a film that was rushed into production. It's one of the films that really kind of accurately depicts college life.
Yeah.
That's kind of uncommon. Mm-hmm. And it's where we start to get away from a lot of the rule baiting and the commentary on cinema, and it becomes a lot more intrinsically about the characters and their relationships.
It becomes a bit more soap operatic. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, the characters are strong enough to handle that. The basic commentary in Scream 2, at least the meta commentary, is the idea that all sequels suck.
Yeah,
that was the idea, and there'd already been proof that that's not 100% true at the time, but the majority of the time when a sequel was made, it was usually rushed into production less than a year later, copies the formula of the original, which Scream 2 did, makes it bigger and broader without necessarily making it better, which Scream 2 did, and the idea is Scream 2 is going to do that and also make it good, which I think they mostly got away with.
Yeah, it's totally watchable movie.
Yeah.
Scream 3 came out
2 years later.
Yeah, a few years
later. It came out in 2000. So it was 96, 97, and then 2000.
It was also Wes Craven, but it was a new screenwriter this time. So it didn't have that sort of Kevin Williamson patois. He has a certain kind of conversational style in his screenplays that it's really very appealing.
This one was written by Aaron Kruger, who is no Kevin Williamson. Although I still quite like Scream 3 a lot. Scream 3...
Queerness noticeably absent.
That's a good point. I do still think it's got a definite commentary about misogyny and sexism. Whereas the original two Scream movies were about... people who said that, movies don't make psychos, to quote the movie. Mm. It's not a term I'd use. Movies don't make psychos. Movies make psychos more creative. Scream 3, which takes place in Hollywood on the production of the Stab sequel, Stab 3.
Stab is the in-universe version of Scream.
Yeah, the movies that they made out of
in the
real life
events. Scream series, they're making movies of the events of the first Scream movie.
And what I like about Scream 3 is, it does it clumsily, but what I like about Scream 3 is that it argues that the institutionalized sexism and misogyny of the Hollywood studio system does have a ripple effect, and it does affect people outside of that system in ways that we can't really predict.
It's super soap operatic because this is all sort of stems from experiences that Neve Campbell's mother, Sydney's mother, had when she was in Hollywood, and it all comes back around to relatives of the main character, which I think is kind of an annoying screenwriting trope, but it does have a point to it at the very least.
It's ultimately about how Harvey Weinstein is an unforgivable monster, and the movie was made under Harvey Weinstein's nose, which I think is kind of interesting.
Dimension Pictures.
Yeah, so it's thoughtful, and I appreciate that it kind of closes the loop on what this kind of thing has always been about, which is about particularly men who are willing to kill because women had agency. And that's what happened with Marion's mother. That's what happened with Sydney. In Scream 2, the killer was, this man did all these horrible things in Scream 1, and I blame Sydney for that.
Yeah.
Rather than blaming the actual person who did it. And it just keeps going in Scream 3. There was a long, long gap. It seemed like Scream had pretty much run its course. And then we had Scream 4 in 2011. And Scream 4 is pretty good.
And that was Kevin Williamson again.
Yeah.
It was Wes Craven again.
Yeah.
And that was Wes Craven's final film. And it was an attempt to sort of... I mean, they hauled all the old cast members out of Mothballs again and put them in front of the camera with a new cast of new characters, a new generation of millennials who have a different view of horror movie fandom.
Yeah.
And
I think most of the young cast of that movie are a little underwritten, except for Hayden Panettiere. That's one of the biggest failing of that film, if you ask me.
And the main character of the young crowd is played by Emma Roberts. And the ultimate message of that film is who can do it better, Gen X or Millennials?
That's one way of looking at it. I don't know.
It's very much sort of this intergenerational thing about how all of these horror movies are being remade, and the current generation of horror fans don't have it as good. They're nursing off the leavings of a previous generation, so they don't have like the same kind of appreciation of horror movies.
I guess I always look at that movie as, it's kind of my take, but my take is a new generation is far enough removed from the previous generation that although they understand the success and popularity of what came before, they don't understand it. Yeah. They don't understand that what Sidney Prescott went through in those movies was horrifying and traumatic. They just know that she got famous. And they don't have the takeaway, and they're not actually bothering to really delve into what made the things work in the first place. They're just doing it in a surfacey way to basically make a quick buck, and this which is kind of the point of that movie, which I appreciate.
Directed by a boomer and written by a Gen Xer, so it's clearly both of them kind of ganging up on millennials, saying, oh, you just care about fame. And it's a little bit bitter, and I appreciate that about Scream 4.
And the way that the pop culture sort of evolved in the wake of Scream 4 just seemed more and more spot on.
Yeah.
In terms of, like, the TikTok cultures and that kind of stuff, and the way that, like, people lived more and more and more online, and the idea that celebrity would become a new form of not just popularity, but currency. Yeah. It's actually, like, you make your living at it.
Social currency, but literal spending currency.
That was actually kind of spot on, actually. Good for them, honestly. They made that work.
And now we're on to Scream, the fifth movie. It is a direct sequel, even though it has the same title. And it, like we said, this is sort of the requel thing where they're trying to do both at the same time.
This one's directed by Matt Bettinelli-Ulpin and Tyler Gillett. I hope I'm pronouncing that right.
Yeah, they are of Ready or Not fame.
Yeah.
Ready or Not, which is a
great movie.
Fun little wicked violent picture about a hide-and-seek game that goes horrendously awry.
Yeah.
And that's all I'm going to say about that. And once again, we're skipping ahead another generation. Enough time has passed since Scream 4 that we're dealing with Zoomers. And we have a new cast of Zoomers. And they go through the beats of Scream. Almost on a scene-by-scene basis.
Not unlike something like The Force Awakens goes through the beats of Star Wars.
It opens the same way the 1996 film opened, with somebody at home alone answering the phone, with the same killer on the other end stalking their home and breaking in.
Except the twist this time is that instead of asking them questions about really old movies like Friday the 13th, they're asking them questions about really old movies like Scream.
Well, they're asking them about Stab, so there's a little bit of distance from the actual commentary as a result.
A little bit, but I think it's clear what we're getting at here, because if you think about it, Scream, the original Scream now, is older today than Friday the 13th was when it was considered kind of an old slasher when Scream came out.
Yeah.
So, like, when Drew Barrymore got wrong, like, who the killer was in the original Friday the 13th, because, like, it's kind of old, people kind of get them all kind of confused or whatever like that, but if you're a real horror fan, like, and you watch them a lot, that's probably not going to get you. It's you realize that, like, oh shit, there's a whole generation into which that's Scream now. It's kind of interesting.
I do appreciate that the victim at the beginning, she's looking up the trivia on her phone while the killer's stalking her. That was kind of good. Something Drew Barrymore couldn't have done in 1996. Yeah. In fact, in 96, you put it this way before, having a mobile phone was like supervillain power.
Yeah, the police talked about...
Because it was 1996, you didn't have a mobile phone that much.
Yeah, they were around, but they were, A, they were clunky, and B, they were a little uncommon, they were still pretty expensive, high schoolers didn't typically have them.
So if you were on the phone, you were at home. You were in or at a friend's house or inside in a building that had a landline.
Yeah, you were stuck. You were wherever you were.
That a killer could talk to you on the phone while being outside of your house walking around was this weird novel thing.
It was really creepy. Like, you mean they could have called from anywhere? Yeah, that's an actual line from Scream. And today it's hilarious, but at the time, that was new.
So this young victim is savaged but not killed. She's put in the hospital and her older sister, who is living in Modesto, California, with her boyfriend, played by
Jack Quaid.
Yeah, it looks exactly like Randy Quaid. So I had
he looks like Joshua Jackson, who was in Scream 2.
Oh, there you go.
So for a second, I was like, wait a minute, we're gonna find out they're related. Wait, what's going on? It's so hard to keep track.
Yeah, the main character, she's played by Melissa Barrera.
Yeah, from In the Heights fame.
Yeah, and here she's playing a character who was unfortunately born without a personality.
That's not fair.
Okay, I'll be fair. None of them have personality.
Oh my god, you're really going to be this guy.
I am. All right. I'll just say it outright. I really disliked this movie. Quite a bit, to a point where it makes me dislike the other ones in retrospect.
Oh my god.
I'm just not a Scream person anymore.
Okay.
They go through all of the beats. The one big twist is that the Melissa Barrera character has a dark secret in her past, because when she looks in the mirror, she sees none other than Skeet Ulrich, who was the killer from the first Scream movie, in the mirror next to her, digitally de-aged, of course. He looks like a teenager.
Yeah, pretty convincing.
Yeah, the effect works. Good special effects. Yeah. And he talks to her saying, what are you going to tell them, the secret? And the secret is...
Can I say? No, let's not. Okay.
I won't say what the secret is, but she does see the ghost of Billy Loomis and has conversations with him. It's nothing supernatural. It's like a psychological thing going on.
But the idea is that there is a deeper connection between these characters we've never met before to the original series. The new ghost face or ghost faces, because there's usually more than one, are on a killing spree. And I will say this, Radio Silence, they up the ante on the violence on this one. This one's quite brutal. Slow stabbings and, everything's visualized a lot more clearly. More daylight murders. Yeah. Right in the street, actually, which is really unsettling.
There's a really fun one, just, in front of somebody's house.
In the middle of the day.
In the middle of the day on a porch. It's really nice.
It's something like we're used to seeing horrifying things happen in the middle of the night or in the shadows. And while it's scary, there's also this part of you in the back of your head where, that's where that would happen. But when you have something terrifying happen, right out in the open, there's something about it that always freaks me out more, way more, whoa, I didn't know you could do that in the middle of the day. That's not right. That's just rude at that point.
And of course, because these killings have begun again, and these killings do pop up from time to time, because these are all part of the same continuity.
Yeah, the fifth time they've happened.
Yeah, the
sixth, if you count the first killing of Maureen Prescott.
It's takes place in a fictional town called Woodsboro.
Yeah, Woodsboro, California.
And in Woodsboro, these murders do happen from time to time, and there's copycats that rise up from time to time. Everybody's aware of it, so of course they call in some of the cast members from the original Scream, and they all come back.
Yeah.
And David Arquette is there to do some acting. Neve Campbell and Courtney Cox are there to do... Well, they stand around.
They mostly show up towards the end. They don't have as much going on.
They don't do a lot. They clearly don't want to be there. They look really bored.
I think Neve Campbell showed up to do her job. I think Courtney Cox looks a little bored.
Yeah.
David Arquette's giving a real performance.
He's at least trying to act a little bit.
I think he gets away with that. I think you see that this is... The experience of all these Scream movies has really worn on him.
Yeah.
They've taken a toll. And I appreciate it.
We catch up with his character, and he's divorced in a trailer, and he's an alcoholic, and he's just really miserable. So yeah, he's kind of his life is not in the happiest place at the moment.
Yeah. I will say this, unlike Scream 4, which as I said before, I think one of the biggest problems with that movie is that, ostensibly, this is a new Scream. It's 10 years after the last Scream. It's a new Scream for a new generation. But the emphasis was so squarely on the older cast members that all the younger cast members barely made any impact whatsoever. Almost none of them had anything resembling an arc or had a meaningful backstory or some way you could even really differentiate them from one another. And I think that's something they clearly wanted to avoid in this one, because I feel like the young cast in this does take center stage, in part because Dewey is the only recurring character who has a meaningful amount of screen time. So these younger people really do have to fill that void. I think Jasmine Savoy Brown and who plays her brother? Hold on.
The
twins.
Yeah.
The twins.
There's two twins,
who are distantly related to Randy.
Mason Gooding is his name.
Mason Gooding. They're fun.
He was in Booksmart.
Yeah. They're very, very fun actors. They really do feel like they're part of the Kevin Williamson sort of universe, even though Williamson isn't credited as a writer here. I think Jack Quaid is holding his own really, really well here. He plays a guy who hasn't seen the Scream movies and is gradually catching up, and that works. This one works for me. I think this works for me as a traditional slasher. I think the actual kills are different and inventive enough and staged in a really, a meaningfully cinematic way. You're wrong. You're wrong about everything you're about to tell me. I really, really like the kills in this movie.
You may, but they are not creatively staged. My issue with the Scream movie, and the thing that makes, and there's some commentary at the end, and they actually sort of we do get to learn who the killer or killers might be and what their motivation is. There's always exposition dumps at the ends of these things where the killers explain their motivation. That's one of the cliches they're kind of making fun of.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a little bit of commentary as to why they're doing what they do, and it has a lot to do with horror fandom and the modern state of it.
And really just fandom in general.
Fandom in general. Yeah.
When I brought up Star Wars, the movie brings up Star Wars too. That kind of fandom is what we're talking about here.
The commentary itself feels like maybe 5 years out of date.
Really?
Because a lot of it has to do with sort of modern fandom and how internet trolls are a big part of that. And you know, after 4 years of having an internet troll as a president, it feels like slight and kind of backward to start bringing it up now. It's like, no, you need to bring this up maybe 4 years ago.
Well, and we didn't get the movie actually made 4 years ago.
No, we didn't.
You feel like it's no longer relevant? I feel like it's relevant.
It would feel
it's not ahead of its time, but it's certainly relevant.
It's a little behind its time, and it would feel more relevant if the filmmakers believed it. This is it's very lifeless. There's not a lot of energy or momentum in any of this. The skills aren't scary. The humor isn't funny. The tension moments aren't tense. It feels really perfunctory. And it's that perfunctory feeling that makes me feel like, wait a minute, Scream just doesn't have anything anymore. They just have repeated commentary from reviews of the last Scream movie. And they're not really bringing any kind of new ideas. And if they were going to repeat old ideas, they need to believe it. And I can tell that these filmmakers really don't care. And as a result, I really don't care. So I'm walking out of this thing disappointed with not just this Scream, but with the Scream series in general. That I'm looking back over these and thinking, this is it. Is it? They kind of robbed the previous films of their creativity in hindsight.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just completely, I feel like I can't be a fan of these movies anymore. I just don't care as much because they don't care as much. And there's no passion behind this any longer. We're just sort of trotting. And if that is part of the commentary of this new Scream, that in May, you know, sort of like rebooting these things and trying to bring them back out and sort of cynically cash in on the old faces. And you're sort of lampshading the fact that you're doing that in this movie, but lampshading your own shortcomings doesn't change the fact that you have shortcomings.
I'm gonna stop right there. First off, I think lampshading your shortcomings has always been part of Scream. Even right from the beginning, when Neve Campbell talks about how, like, oh, everyone in a slasher movie always runs upstairs when they should run outside, and then that's the first thing they immediately do.
That's always been part of genre troping. It's not the movie itself.
But the movie still does it though. Yeah. The movie is creating a space wherein they can say, okay, we know, but it's fun, so we're gonna do it. And I think that's where that's at. Generally speaking, everything you just said, I respect you and I love you as a person and as a critic, but I'm going to quote my cousin Vinny here. Everything that guy just said is BS. I just couldn't disagree more. I actually, when I said the skills were staged creatively, that may have been slightly misworded. I believe they are presented classily. I believe that they are presented in a way that actually is not just about shock and gore. I think they present it in a way where they actually care about the characters and their plight, and we're under the assumption that we don't want to see them killed, and the characters are written and the actors are presenting them in such a way that I don't. When people die in this movie, I give a shit. Okay. Even more so than I did in other good Scream movies like Scream 4 or Scream 3. I really, really liked this cast. I think mostly they're very well written. Few more so than others, I'll grant you, but that's true for almost anything. This is not a badge of honor or anything like that, but it did hurt the movie a little bit for me. I guessed who the killer was, like, really early on in Scream 4. Like, in Scream 4, like, I knew it, like, within, like, 20 minutes. Like, it seemed pretty obvious to me, and it kind of bore out. This one, didn't quite see exactly how it was going to come together, and I thought that was fun. Yeah, I thought they actually remembered that Scream was also supposed to be kind of a whodunit, and I thought that worked rather well. I appreciated that no one is safe. I appreciate that, like, legacy characters, I'm not going to say who, but characters who were introduced in previous movies are not immortal like they were in Scream 4, which also, I think, hurt that film a little bit. Made it feel like everyone's just a little too safe. it's not really scary at that point if some people are guaranteed to be fine. I think that was a slick play. I agree that the conversation that this movie's having about toxic fandom is not new. However, yeah. I also think that it is 100% contemporary and relevant. It's literally happening, like, while I was in the theater waiting to see Scream and looking at my phone, I was seeing shit like that, like, on Twitter, like, right now. Just because it's not brand spanking new and ahead of its time doesn't mean that it's not commenting on something relevant. And when you say that the filmmakers don't believe maybe in like the requel format, I think they detest it. I think they're actually quite mad that this is what fandom has demanded, is that instead of doing something new and interesting and fun, we have to go back to this. Well, and I think that the viciousness of the violence in some of these death scenes and the viciousness of some of the commentary is basically them just saying, we would have liked to have done something else too. But well, instead, this is what you demand of your horror movies. And so this is what we're stuck with. Surely, Scream is only allowed to be what is currently popular, and it needs to comment on that and try to push it forward while doing exactly what's happening right now.
So surely if you sense then that the filmmakers don't want to be doing what they're doing, that surely that's a detriment to the film.
No, I don't. I disagree. Right. Actually, I think the point is to comment on the genre and to critique the genre, which Scream has always done. I think a harsh critique is fair.
Since slashers, even retro slashers, that Scream spawned a bunch of imitators.
Yeah, ironic slashers
Urban Legend.
I know what you did last summer. Valentine's Day.
But yeah.
Oh, that's right. It was Valentine.
There was a brief slew of Scream imitators in the late 90s. Some of them were okay.
Yeah.
Most of them were pretty pat.
Most of them were pretty forgettable. A few hold up real good.
Scream didn't really revive the slasher genre, though. It was kind of like the button on the genre. And the sequels were just sort of like extensions from that.
Mm.
At the beginning of the new Scream, the killer is quizzing the young heroine. And
What's your favorite scary movie?
And she says stuff like The Babadook and It Follows, you know, the A24 kinds of movies.
Yeah, I love that that's kind
Wouldn't
of
it have been keen if the new Scream was in that style, where there wasn't a lot of dialogue and a lot of slow, sustained shots and really hazy photography. Mm-hmm. And we get to see Ghostface just sort of standing there and everybody acknowledges him, but nobody can see him.
I will say this right now. I would love it if that was the take for if there's another one of these. And it's doing very well, so I wouldn't be surprised. I would love it if that's a take for the next one. Mm-hmm. I think in this one, we're commenting on the fact that some fans refuse to move on.
Yeah.
And won't let anything new happen. What this one is about, and that's what this one is basically just... Because all Scream movies are basically about toxic fandoms.
Yeah.
They all are. They're all about people who see a horror movie and decide that their love of horror...
That's really keen.
Well, it's not even that that's really keen. It's that their love of horror movies gives them the right to dehumanize and treat other people like shit. Mm. And whether that's actually killing is kind of incidental, basically. So it's always been about toxic fandom. Every single Scream villain has been a toxic fan on some level or another. So I think that's kind of where they're at right now. But I would love to see this take... I remember when Scream 3 came out.
Mm.
And one of the things that Randy said in like this video that he recorded in Scream 2, it was a very cute bit. He was talking about, yes, and the killer will be invincible now. And that's a whole bit where they shoot the killer multiple times and it keeps coming after him. And the gag is he's just wearing a bulletproof vest.
Yeah.
But like for a moment, like Dewey like shoots him and he's just like, but he's invincible now. It's like, dude, we're not supernatural yet. But what if we were? What if we actually went supernatural? Well, you know, it took Jason Voorhees 6 movies to go supernatural. Why not now?
A lot of people have asked, if you're going to make another Scream, don't make Scream, make Stab.
Well, I've said this. I would love that.
And there is allusion to a movie called Stab, which is Stab 8, within the fabric of Scream 5.
Directed by Ryan Johnson.
It's directed by Ryan Johnson, and in it, it's like their ghost face now is like big buff arms that are like exposed as like killing people with a flamethrower. I want to see that movie.
I also want to see that movie.
That should have been Scream 5.
It's like
the in-universe version of the Scream events have become so wild that it doesn't even resemble a good movie anymore.
I seriously wish we could do that. I think that would be very, very... I would love it if
it's frustrating that we're at a point where they all they can do is comment on how uncreative everything is.
Yeah.
Because all we're getting is an uncreative movie.
Well, you could say that about Scream 1, couldn't you?
Yeah, well, Scream 1 was commenting on larger genre tropes. Uh-huh. Scream 5 is commenting on Scream movies.
No, but it's also, it's commenting on the current franchise phenomenon, which Scream is merely a part. Again, right. They're commenting, a lot of the things that they're commenting on apply just as much to Star Wars Rise of Skywalker as they do to Scream, as they do to Halloween, as they do to Jurassic World. I think that's all relevant. I think that's all fine. I think Scream has always been about having your cake and eating it too. Always been about completely reveling in the exact same things that we know are kind of ludicrous, but we like them and we're going to do them. And I think that there's a lot of stuff in this movie that Radio Silence really does like doing. But I think what they're commenting on, what they're angry at, is the idea of toxic fans not letting people move on. And I think there's so much more you could do with this. And I think the stage is set that maybe we can say goodbye to some of the, even the legacy characters who are alive at the end of this, and just sort of move on and let this be its own thing now. And that would be exciting. And I would love to see, because these are clever filmmakers. They're definitely energetic and, you know, they make good movies. I would like to see what they could do when they're unfettered.
Yeah.
When they're unleashed. And I think that this is a great movie to sort of sever the past. And then maybe we can move on. But whatever. If they make another one, I'll deal with whatever it is when we get to it, however it turns out.
I felt like that was the function of Scream 4, was to sever the past.
Mm-hmm.
Now is the chance to do something more interesting.
I would have said that if there wasn't for the coda in Scream 4. If Scream 4 had ended where it looks like it's going to end.
Okay.
With the bad guy winning.
Okay.
And that had been it. That would have been amazing. That would have been the best ending.
Yeah.
I would have been the coolest fucking thing ever. Mm-hmm. I was celebrating in the theater. I was like, oh my God, this is the coolest thing ever. And then there's this long epilogue where everything turns out okay, and it turns out all of the legacy heroes are fine. Yeah. And I'm like, no.
It's like that,
I feel like Hannibal Lecter. No, you were doing fine.
It's like that scene.
You were courteous
and
receptive to courtesy.
Kiss, kiss, bang, bang. It's like, oh yes, and he was okay too. And like, there's this epilogue. It's like, oh, and all the dead characters come back in, and then they also bring in Abraham Lincoln and Elvis. Yeah. Like, they're all alive again.
Yeah. It's the mega happy ending. And I feel like Scream 4 threw that away. Yeah. And I feel like Scream 2022 doesn't throw it away. I feel like we're in a place now where it's like, yeah, we can, you know, we're in a good place to move on. And unlike Scream 4, which, even if it had ended where I said it ended, really didn't have a supporting cast to carry through to more movies. This one, I think they wisely left certain people in play so that there could be a supporting cast to carry through and be the new Scream.
Okay.
Rather than just keep having to go back to the old well. Oh, by the way, Kenny survived somehow. Remember Kenny? Fuck it. Kenny's back. There was apparently an attempt multiple times to like bring Matthew Lillard back, saying Stu had somehow survived. I'm glad they didn't. That would have been a step too far. Yeah,
although we get there's a character related to him as well.
There is.
Played by an actor named Kyle Gallner, who was in the Friday the 13th remake or Nightmare on Elm Street remake.
Yeah. He was also in Veronica Mars. He's a good actor, actually. Anyway, I clearly like this a lot more than you.
I was just kind of grossed out and bored by the entire thing by the end of this one.
Again, you don't go to slasher movies to see something completely revolutionary, and I think, ironically, Scream is kind of built on being revolutionary, but it never has been. It's always been about toiling in the milieu, take a drink, that exists, and finding some way to sort of make it pop through strong writing. And I like the writing here. I think it works.
The curious thing about continuing the Scream series is Scream is the only thing left that's kind of keeping slashers alive. They do come
aground
occasionally, and Halloween as well.
Halloween is still doing well.
The last, I've seen a few, like very few original slashers in the last couple of years. There was one, at a boarding school.
Was it Seance?
Seance.
Yeah, I actually still haven't seen
it. I saw Seance. That's a slasher movie. Just sort of straight-up slasher. I mean, the genre is very moribund. It's many, many years out of date at this point.
There's Someone Inside Your House came out last year. That was a very good slasher.
Okay.
Just doesn't necessarily disprove your point. Oh, Freaky! Freaky was a good slasher. It's a high-concept slasher.
Freaky's okay. It's
Happy Birthday to You was a good slasher.
Body swap movie. But yeah, point being,
Fear Street. We had three great slasher movies last year.
Right. I, All good examples.
Okay.
For the last couple of years.
Wait a minute.
I still think I'm safe in saying, however.
Okay.
That they're not the center of horror right now.
That's fair. That's 100% true.
The genre is a retro genre.
Yeah, yeah. It's like Westerns. We still make them, but they're not pushing the medium forward.
Fear Street, yes. Fear Street's set in 1994, isn't it? And also 1978, isn't it?
I know.
So it's
Westerns are set in the Old West.
Yeah, the same thing. So these sort of like commentaries on slasher movies aren't for modern horror fans. Yeah, they're fair. Kind of trying to teach younger horror fans what older horror fans are all about. And
that's fair.
As such, the whole idea of unpacking modern fandom with slashers seems a little bit odd to me.
I can appreciate that. That's a fair comment. That's a fair point. I do think that's what you get when you make a Scream movie. I don't think you can switch to a superhero movie.
2022.
Yeah. I don't think you get to They
could have switched to something really like scary, like atmospheric, the A24.
I hope if they make more of these, they give that a try. Yeah, there's
a scene where because this always happens in a Scream movie, where they get the drop on the bad guy, and it looks like they've killed the person in the ghost face costume, or it looks like they're knocked out. And, of course, they turn around, and when they turn back, they're gone. Wouldn't it have been nice if they turn away, they turn back, and there's, like, four of them.
Yeah, something really blows your fucking mind.
And they turn around, and the elevator doors open, and there's, like, four more in the elevator. Yeah. It's like, what the hell is going on?
I was waiting for something
just actually unexpected.
I keep waiting for, like, one of these things, like, it's going to be, like, a Wicker Man scenario or something like that, where there's a whole town of ghost faces, right? That'd be scary, like... There's so many things you could do. But that's my point. There are things you can do with Scream that would still blow your mind.
How come they didn't do them now?
I get it. I see your point. But I'm reviewing the movie we got. And I like the movie we got. Mm-hmm. I would love to see them take this in a different direction next time. And I hope they do.
All right.
But regardless, we review the movie we get. I like the movie we got. I think it is a rock solid Scream movie. I think it is one of the better Scream movies. And I would say that even though I like some Scream movies more than others, I don't think we've ever had a bad one. I think this is a pretty consistent franchise, and that's a lot. I think it's when you have a long-running series of movies, consistency is a lot to ask for, but it's always appreciated. that's what you get from Final Destination. That's what you get from Tremors. That's what you get from arguably the MCU. That builds a fandom. Yeah, so kudos. And honestly, without Wes Craven, being able to produce a film that feels like Scream is impressive in and of itself.
I suppose so, especially since what he did is no longer part of like the general cinematic vernacular.
No, I feel like some of his movies could be considered A24-ish. Hills Have Eyes,
even The Serpent and the Rainbow is a little bit like heady and psychedelic.
It's clumsy in a lot of ways, but I think People Under the Stairs. Mm. It's something that would still totally play today. People call it too on the nose today.
I like the People Under the Stairs.
It's an amazing motion picture. It's one of his best films. It's a really scary, awesome movie. And I still maintain that as much as I love Scream, arguably his best meta commentary is still New Nightmare, which is brilliant.
I like New Nightmare better, even better than I like Scream. And I like the original.
For me, they're
Scream
on par. It depends on the day. But yeah.
Yeah. I feel like we haven't had a bad Scream until now. I feel like this is not a good film. It's not adding anything. And I would be okay with it if it were like a skilled scary movie. Okay. If it actually did feel brutal or daring or scary in some kind of way, and it just doesn't. It feels really kind of dead.
All right. Well, we disagree, and that's okay sometimes, isn't it? I'm very curious if we disagree about the next one, because if you want to talk about a sequel to a long-running series that really stinks up the joint, let's talk about Hotel Transylvania 4, Transformania. I gotta say, and we've talked about this multiple times whenever it comes up, you know, Adam Sandler has gotten a lot of crap throughout a lot of his career for making a lot of, like, lowbrow, unambitious,
mean-spirited,
often
comedy
mean-spirited
films,
comedies, which just, damn it, don't really feel like they're trying very hard. They usually do well. But there's been this bright, shining light in Adam Sandler's
film. The one wonderful exception to all of
this. He'll occasionally pull out a Punch Drunk Love or Uncut Gems, something like really art house and awesome, and he's great at that. But, like, the family-friendly thing that he did that was actually really kick-ass were the first three Hotel Transylvania movies, to one extent or another. They're not all equal.
The first Hotel Transylvania was made by Genndy Tartakovsky.
Yeah.
Who is just a giant in animation.
He did Samurai Jack. He did... Oh, what's that like caveman one he did recently? It's like, was it like Feral?
Yeah, I think it was called Feral. I didn't see it, but yeah, I know what you're talking about.
I'm gonna look that up. I just want to make sure, because I actually haven't seen that yet, but I heard it's Primal.
Primal. The one.
That's a big deal. Genndy Tartakovsky is an animator, honestly, par excellence. He really pushes the medium, and he knows what he's doing.
And Genndy Tartakovsky, if you're familiar with his style, he works in very, like, stark shapes. He likes the sort of early 60s kind of limited animation, shape-based character design, where everybody is really kind of blocky and a lot of pointed angles.
But then he animates the hell out of them.
Yeah. And
that's the beauty of it.
And he also is really keen on, like, really slow, quiet portions that are punctuated by extended periods of extreme chaos.
Yeah. And his Clone Wars animated series is so fucking good.
And I'm a big fan of Samurai Jack. And I'm a big fan of the first Hotel Transylvania, even though it's so frantic. I felt like I didn't have enough sugar in my system to consume it properly. And the premise of the first one is Count Dracula, played by Adam Sandler, has retired from being a ghoul of the night and now runs a hotel for itinerant monsters who want to go on vacation.
Yeah, the idea is that it's hard to be a monster. Humans hate you and they always want to destroy you. And having a place that you can go to relax, where you're all tucked away, it's like a Club Med for monsters, is just something that it's a service he feels he can provide at his castle in Transylvania. And it's really, really cute. He's got a daughter named Mavis, who he's been kind of living a sheltered life. And in the first movie...
A mere 118, I think.
She's in her teens. In walks in that first movie, just a hitchhiker, a backpacker.
One of those... he's clearly modeled off of Aaron Ralston from the film 127 Hours. This sort of, like, adventure dude. Like, designed... He's played by Andy Samberg. And, he is... So, like, this upbeat hippie guy who's so healthy and into being outdoors, that when he runs into a hotel for monsters, he's kind of unfazed.
Yeah, at first he's like, oh, weird, but he's actually like, this is awesome. Mm-hmm. I love all of this.
Also, he instantly falls in love with Count Dracula's daughter, Mavis. Who falls in love with him. In turn, she's played by Selena Gomez.
Yeah.
And it is about, can these two find romance?
And can Dracula acknowledge that while he has secluded himself, the world has moved on. And in fact, monsters are popular now. Mm. Like, monsters are drive economies.
Although they have things wrong. Dracula does not go blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, I never go blah, blah, blah. It's a funny bit. I've never heard anyone say Dracula did that either, which is weird. I don't know. But in any case, the first Hotel Transylvania, fun premise.
Well, and
wonderfully animated very funny. That's the thing I love about it.
I wanted to say that the animation was actually really revolutionary because I actually heard Genndy Tartakovsky talk about it.
Yeah.
CGI is, in his words, they're like puppets.
Yeah.
Where
that's how people use them. You create a model and then you can
like stretch them as much as you would stretch a puppet, but there's a limit to what you can do. And he wanted to change that about CG animation. Could he do it? Because he was used to doing cell animation. And I think Hotel Transylvania does.
Yeah.
It finds this balance where you can do sort of actual characters in 3D space. You can just kind of rotate the camera around them. But at the same time, he's good with, like, sort of stark profiles and these weird sort of uses of color and shape that aren't ordinarily seen in CGI features.
It's more Looney Tune than Pixar.
Yeah, I think between Hotel Transylvania, Peanuts, and Captain Underpants, that a little bit more of a cartoon, an old-fashioned cartoony style started working its way into CG.
Yeah.
And it was a relief because it was great to look at.
Yeah. And that's true for Hotel Transylvania 2, which is basically Andy Samberg and Selena Gomez's characters, they have a kid. Dracula has to get used to that idea. And will the kid be a vampire or a human? It's always had this kind of weird guess who's coming to dinner vibe. It's not a particularly memorable film, but it's also funny and light, and it mostly works. The third one is basically a throwaway. It's just, hey, what if we put all the characters on a cruise ship? Well, there, which is basically like a sitcom plot.
I haven't seen the third one, but yeah, it's a sitcom plot. And one of the gags of the Hotel Transylvania movies is that Count Dracula is just a dippy sitcom dad.
Yeah.
And fine, that's the premise of the Munsters.
The whole premise with Dracula, like his whole hang-up after he gets over the whole humans thing, is he's terrified of confrontation. That's it. Everything he does, he's afraid of telling Mavis an unpleasant truth or something awkward. He's in Hotel Transylvania 3, he falls in love with Van Helsing's daughter or granddaughter, and he's afraid to talk to her. Like, he's just can't handle emotional confrontation or anything that, like, might make him look imperfect.
So here we are to Hotel Transylvania Transformania, and it is the cusp of Dracula's retirement. He's now living with the Catherine Hahn character, Van Helsing's daughter or granddaughter.
Yeah.
Van Helsing is in this. I didn't see the third, so I didn't know the deal with Van Helsing.
Oh, that must have been weird.
He's a severed head who has like a transforming robot body and a lab in the cyborg. And a lab in the hotel. He's played by Jim Gaffigan. One of the cute visual bits in this one is that he has this series of tunnels that he can only fit through if he transforms in a certain way.
Yeah.
And it makes for this kind of interesting visual flow.
Yeah.
And at the very beginning of the movie, in order to celebrate, I think it's his anniversary of the hotel, the Andy Samberg character, the human character, decides to throw a big party, and it's a big and showy, and has an ice sculpture and fire juggling, and Dracula doesn't like this at all.
It's not classy.
He feels like he's not a classy guy, and so he starts to have second thoughts about retiring from the hotel business and leaving the hotel to his daughter and her husband.
When they find out a little early, Andy Samberg's character goes up to Dracula and says, thank you, I promise I won't screw this up, and immediately talks about how he's almost certainly going to screw this up. And Dracula says, oh, no, I wanted to.
But he's changed his mind.
He makes up a fictional racist real estate law.
Yes.
That says you're not allowed to leave monster property to humans. And that's something they will not unpack.
No, not at all.
They will not even talk about that.
This is the Monster Mash. This is the Monsters. This is Monster Squad. This is a very kiddie understanding of the way monsters operate.
Yeah, I get it.
They're not really dangerous. Over the plot of this movie, for instance, Van Helsing has a magic crystal that can turn humans into monsters and vice versa.
Andy Samberg says, I know what I'll do. I'll shoot myself with this thing and become a monster. All problems solved. Dracula finds out about this, and he's trying to turn Andy Samberg back human before Mavis finds out, because Dracula can't handle confrontation. And in the process, he accidentally transforms himself and some of the other main monsters into humans.
What I was going to get at is that he's a vampire, right?
Yeah.
How do you become a vampire? You get bit by a vampire.
I know.
Just you're surrounded by other vampires. I just know. Ask one of them.
The whole thing is, oh no, I've been turned into a human, and the crystal that works makes this ray gun work is rare.
And of course it breaks and it's rare, and they have to go to
South America, like all the way around the world, in order to get this crystal, fix it, turn Dracula back into a monster before Mavis finds out. You have Mavis bite you.
Just say, like, hey, I'm a human, bite me.
It's not like the ray gun, like, doesn't work that way. Like, oh, you can only be turned back into a ray gun. Because there's a gag, it's one of only two funny gags in the movie, where a stray blast from the ray gun hits one of Dracula's zombie bellhops.
Oh, and turns him into a human.
And turns him into a human. It's like, oh my god, I'm human again.
The nightmare is over.
And then another zombie bellhop just immediately bites him, and he turns into a zombie again and goes, eh, it's a living. And he goes back to his shit.
There's a few fun visual, just a few fun visual things in here. That zombie bit was funny.
Yeah.
In order to test the monster ray, they zap a guinea pig, and that becomes a running gag, that the guinea pig becomes more and more monstrous, and they end up scaring it into the ducts, and I feel like, oh no, you're going to have a ductwork sequence where people are crawling through the ductwork, but they
never
end up just
together,
connecting it together to like a big hamster habit trail. I thought that was kind of cute. Some visual stuff near the end of the movie when all of the monsters, now humans, are in an ice cave, and they use sort of like refracting images to sort of like make the chase seem like it's happening from several angles at the same
time. But that feels like they're just desperately trying to polish this turd.
Well, this is not Genndy Tartakovsky directing. It's Genndy Tartakovsky's story, and he is one of the co-screenwriters. But this is a different animator trying to do the same thing. And I feel like, let me look up the director's names.
It's two directors, actually. Yeah, they're, Jennifer Kluska and Derek Dryman.
Okay. They do a capable job of making, an affable kid.
It's energetic.
Energetic kid movie, but they clearly don't have the same sense of style as Genndy Tartakovsky.
It's not even just the style, just the story just doesn't work here. Like, on top of the fact that this is a gigantic plot hole, and like, even like after Mavis finds out, and a lot of the problems
bite
could
him
be
in that moment. Just
bite his pinky. Whatever, doesn't have to be weird.
Because this is
this?
A kid version of these monsters, they don't actually drink blood.
But they zombies don't eat human flesh, but we saw a zombie bite a guy.
Yeah, that's true.
Why not? It doesn't fucking matter.
And there's a few setups for gags that don't pay off, unfortunately. Yeah. I wish we had known a little bit more about the blob. The blob drinks some magic potion that turns it into, not a person, but a jello mold.
Apparently, that's what it was originally before it turned into a monster. It was a jello mold. That raises a lot of questions.
I want to know that story.
Yeah.
It's like the
blob is the funniest thing about Hotel Transylvania.
It's like the
3.
The wrench in Freaked.
Yeah. There's in the movie Freaked, there's a flashback from a wrench and how it started out as a hammer.
No, it started as a wrench and it became a hammer.
Apologies. It started as a wrench and then it was horrifically mutated by a madman.
Everybody's telling their backstories like, oh yes, I came here when I was searching for worms and he turned me into a worm, and they pan over to the next guy. Yes, and I was turned into a sock, and they pan over to a hammer on the ground. And we see the flashback, and it's the bad guy shopping at a hardware store. He grabs a wrench off the shelf and just laughs maniacally. Ha ha ha! Fade back to the hammer and everybody's sobbing.
Like, that's the sad one. So the main plot doesn't work. And a lot of people talk about like the CinemaSins thing, like, oh, plot holes. That's a huge plot hole.
Well, it's
like, it's gigantic and it's right there in your face. It would be like
something a little kid would notice.
It's not small. Like, it's really kind of everything kind of hinges on it. The whole idea of, oh, will Dracula accept this guy as part of the family? This is the fourth movie about that. And I think we kind of are past it now. I get that they always have personalities that will clash, but the whole, will I accept you as part of the family? No, we did that three times already. We can move on now. Like, that itself is just really, really tired. And then on top of it all, there's this whole bit where the monster that Andy Samberg's character turns into... He turns into a dragon, and over the course of the film, he keeps growing bigger and bigger until he's like the size of Godzilla, which is a funny idea in theory. In practice...
Godzilla hates Dracula.
First off, Godzilla versus Dracula is a fun idea. I would like to see that, but we're not going to really get that, because the whole thing is, when he finds out that Dracula, like, only made up that lie and, like, was never wanting to give him the hotel and everything like that, he runs off all super angry.
Resents that he's not part of the family.
And I get it. You want to set up Dracula versus Godzilla at the end there. Cool. Awesome. The problem is that the person who runs after him isn't Dracula, it's Mavis, and he starts attacking Mavis. And that makes me hate him. You're telling me you're mad at her father, and you're going to take it out on your wife? I get that he's a monster, but
his eyes turn red. He's clearly losing humanity.
It's a weird note to strike in a kid's movie. All I'm saying. That's a weird note to strike. I don't think it plays. The simplicity of the story is kind of what we need in Hotel Transylvania. We just need a setup for gags. The setup sucks. The gags don't work. And even the baseline characters are either going through something we've seen them do before and better, or they just don't make sense. Nothing about this movie works.
There's so many things you could have done with the characters turning into humans.
Yes! And vice versa.
One of the gags is, I do like the bit that the Invisible Man isn't used to wearing clothes.
Yeah.
He's just naked all the time.
That's kind of funny. Yeah. You know. Can you do something with that?
And in fact, when he appears, this is a cute visual bit, we see his butt first, and we see like two gigantic, like, it looks like a butt. Like, the two butt cheeks kind of like rammed together right in front of the camera. It's like, it's pretty raw for a kid's film.
Honestly, it is. It's a bit much, honestly, but like, yeah.
Like I said, there's a little bits here and there of creativity that are keeping it from being a complete wash. I agree with you that if you're going to have a premise as simple as this, Monster Ray, you need to just crack the whip on the gags.
Well, because you
have joke after joke after joke.
When you there's a bit, and oftentimes in screenwriting it's called the fun and games, where like after you introduce the premise of the film and you can finally like delve into it, like there's a moment where everyone's like, should we or should we not engage with the plot? And then when they decide, okay, we will accept this call to action, or we will accept this quest, or we will accept what has happened to us. And then you can just have fun for a few minutes. You know, 15, 20 minutes of, okay, so our monsters have become human. Okay, what would they want to do? I don't think they're going to want to go on a quest in the jungles of South America and not interact with people. The whole point of these monsters and the whole hotel is that they can't.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be funnier to see them actually go out into the human world and get to be human for a bit and have that culture clash? Wouldn't it be funny to see some humans besides Andy Samberg turn into monsters and get to interact with monsters? That's the premise.
Frankenstein's,
that's the fun.
Frankenstein's monster joins a sewing club. Sews the people together.
That's kind of funny. there's funny stuff you can do here. But the plot involves, like, we got to go on a quest for a magic crystal. And there's got to be, like, these roller coaster sequences.
It's too adventure-y.
It's all about the plot, and it's not about the premise. And the premise is not a bad premise for a Hotel Transylvania movie. But they do nothing with it. That sucks. Like, I know you weren't impressed by Scream, but at least we got the kills. At least we got the whodunit. At least we got the soap opera shit. At least they gave you what you wanted from the movie. Nothing in this movie is what I want from a Hotel Transylvania movie.
Yeah, well, what I want is more laughs from a Hotel Transylvania movie. And overall, this one's pretty disappointing. It feels a little bit too plain.
Yeah.
Especially when compared to how frantic at least the first two are. I haven't seen the third. But yeah, that, like I said, that first one, you need to, like, drink a lot of cola.
Even Hotel Transylvania 3, which is really fucking thin. It's basically like a sitcom. Like, oh, hey, what's going to happen on the season finale of Friends? They're all going to be on a cruise ship. Okay, I can imagine Dracula, what they do on a cruise ship.
Dracula's on a cruise. Is there a gag about him needing to travel with coffins full of earth?
Something like that. My point is this. They think about what would monsters on a cruise ship. What are the gags? They thought out the gags. They gave us the gags. It's not a brilliant movie, but I laughed. That's all I fucking want here. That's all. If these are basically sitcoms, just give me a good sitcom. You gotta wait years in between these things. Give me some fucking jokes. They didn't give me the fucking jokes. This sucks.
And these movies are hits. And this was going to be a theatrical release. Sony sold these movies to Amazon for like $100 million. And
they sold some stuff to Netflix too. That's how the Mitchell's Machines got made.
There you go. There's going to be another. They've already, there's already another Hotel Transylvania in production. There's a TV series as well. So these things are going to continue apace.
Yeah.
Let's keep our fingers crossed and hope that this one was the misguided one and that they get back to sort of the more comedic roots. Gendy Tartakovsky is going to be involved moving forward. I don't know who's directing the next one.
Other people besides Gendy Tartakovsky can make good animated comedy.
The idea of having kid-friendly versions of classic Universal monsters is a concept as old as the Monster Mash. And, heck, it's as old as Abbott Costello.
Abbott Costello. Yeah. I think that's where we started doing that in earnest,
where we can take these really well-known movie figures from the 30s and 40s and turn them into comedic foils.
As great as Hotel Transylvania and its first two sequels are, none of them are as funny as Bela Lugosi taking off his shoe and throwing it at the Wolfman. That's still one of the funniest things I've ever seen in any movie, is Bela Lugosi as Dracula being chased around the house by a wolfman, taking off his shoe and throwing it at the wolfman.
Ah, shoes! My one weakness! Ah! You win this round, Dracula. Recalling a scene from, of all things, Masters of the Universe.
Okay, the movie?
The canon movie.
Okay.
Where a monster is attacking one of the human characters and he throws a rag at him. Like, he's in the kitchen, he's just got a wet rag, he just throws it at the monster. And I just would have loved to have the scene, the monster just sort of, like, grab the rag and fall backward and, like melt.
Assume it's something like,
oh, wow, it's a good thing I threw a rag at the monster. Anyway, let's move on to another film. Because
another animated film.
I think we've said everything we need to say about The Fourth Hotel Transylvania.
The next film is a film from a director who I've called, and I will still say, my favorite living director.
Okay.
Mamoru Hosoda, who has directed some of the best animated movies of the last 10 years or so. Summer Wars is one of my very favorite films. The Boy and the Beast is one of my very favorite films. Wolf Children is one of my very favorite films. Mirai is not one of my favorite films, but it's an excellent motion picture about childhood. He makes these incredible films that are very imaginative, and they're about science fiction or fantasy concepts, but they're always grounded or rooted in something deeply human and humane, something very universal about the human experience.
I haven't seen Summer Wars, and I haven't seen The Boy and the Beast.
Okay.
I think Wolf Children is very sweet. I'm not as not under its spell the same way you are.
Fair.
That's a strong. Most of his films deal with the concerns of younger people, the fragile emotional states of the young, of youths.
Particularly involved in family dynamics.
Yeah. Mirai is one of the few films I've seen that tries to tell a story from within the mind of a toddler.
Yeah.
And kind of how strange and bizarre the world seems when you're that little. Because if you cast your mind back, you might have strange perceptions of the way the world operated.
Your knowledge of the way the world operates is very, very limited, and you're trying to figure it out.
There's a scene where the toddler is lost at a train station, and turns into one of the most nightmarish things you will see on film.
That sequence is amazing.
It's really, really great. And here he is back telling another story of adolescent angst. It's about a teenage girl. There's also a science fiction conceit here. So it's about a teenage girl. She's going to school, and she is suffering through the loss of her mother, who died when she was younger, and she still feels the ache of it even years later. In this world, there is also operating essentially Ready Player One.
You can
put in these little earpieces, and this artificial intelligence will, I guess, sort of in a Great Pumpkin sort of way, intuit your sincere form looks like.
Yeah, you don't create your own avatar. An avatar is created for you out of your personality.
Yeah, and even though she's very shy and she has trouble talking to people and is very down on herself as well, this artificial intelligence creates for her essentially a singing Barbie doll.
Yeah, a beautiful avatar who, and because she herself is a musician, but she's, ever since her mother died, she's struggled to create music. Now that she's, and this avatar, she's not herself. Mm. She's got that, that sort of veil. She's able to finally sing again. And it turns out people love her singing, and quickly she becomes the most famous singer in the world. And she's still in high school, and nobody knows who she is.
She's internet famous, which that's almost like being famous.
Well, in this universe, it's a big deal.
In this universe, and this is all, of course, very, very akin to sort of Instagram fame, getting a lot of likes. This doesn't mean any money or fame for her because she's in disguise this whole time. But
right, but her music is reaching an audience.
She's being validated through this virtual experience,
and I'm with the movie so far.
So yeah, okay, I'm with you. This is Gem and the Holograms.
But it's good. It's good so far.
There are some self-appointed superhero police within this virtual world as well. They're the ones who are like the action junkies. They want to fight.
And their big superpower is they can dox you.
They can reveal your true identity.
Yeah, so that like if you do something that like is like really detrimental to what they perceive as the framework of online society, they can remove your anonymity and expose you for who you really are. And the idea is that will eliminate your power within this space.
So they're not employees of whatever company is running this.
No, they're freelance.
We don't get to know like who built this or what or what it is or why, but it is some big.
It's a big question, honestly, that probably should have been answered.
Probably, yeah. Like, what company runs this? Anyway.
I don't know. I don't think I needed to be the plot, but I think I needed some answers.
While she's in the virtual world giving a virtual concert, wouldn't you know it, a beast arrives. And it's this big monster with horns. And it's essentially a troll trying to wreck the concert. It's an internet troll. And it turns out this beast... nobody knows who it is either, and people are really fascinated by the beast. How dare it interrupt something so pleasant as this concert? She ends up trying to track the beast down and finds it in a big castle. Wouldn't you know it? Now we're in Beauty and the Beast. It's the Beauty and the Beast story.
And she realizes that this internet troll is really it's a human being, obviously. Mm-hmm. And it's someone who is deeply wounded and is actually probably someone in need of very real life help. But I'm not going to go any further in the plot.
Because these things are created out of your subconscious. Mm-hmm. The subconscious of this guy looks like a beast. Wouldn't have been keen if the twist were he were a serial killer. It's nothing so dark.
Yeah.
It's actually far more commonplace. In fact, I was with this movie up until a point. I didn't like that they weren't addressing sort of the nature of how the real world and this fantasy world interplay with one another. It's just sort of about how she's getting a lot of validation from this online experience, which could be seen as just a more advanced version of being on social media, and how there's trolls on social media. It's a big commentary on social media. But then we start getting into some pretty heavy after-school special type of melodrama within this teenager's melodrama. And I understand that when you are a teenager, drama does seem much larger. Everything, you know, every perceived slight seems much bigger than it might be in the real world.
That's why we have the whole young adult subgenre, basically. Yeah, that's why everything feels like post-apocalyptic or monstrous. It's because that's how it feels.
And indeed, I was thinking of the movie Twilight while I was watching Belle, in that the romance and the angst and, you know, your facing of death feels so much larger to this, like, enormous degree. And there are a few sweet moments in the real world where are reminded, vaguely, that these teenager characters are teenagers.
Yeah.
There's a bit where a young boy has to reveal that he has a crush on a young girl, and he just sort of freezes.
It's at the train station?
At the train station.
Oh my god, this sequence I
thought my screener had frozen. Yeah, me too. Because I was watching on a screener.
There's a scene in this movie that takes place at a train station, and this is, Mamoru Hosoda is a brilliant visual storyteller. He's very imaginative, and he uses incredible camera work and color and design to really make everything pop. There's a scene in this movie, an extended scene, that is only from one angle, and huge chunks of it, nobody's moving because everyone is so mortified by the sudden displays of emotion or revelations of who has a crush on who, and it forces you to stop and just sit there and wallow in how awkward it is to be a teenager, like, actually reaching out to someone in the real world. That bit is masterful. The level of control and the confidence you have to be able to have to let a whole scene play out like that in any medium, let alone animation, astonishing, good.
That it's a cute moment, and this film could have used a couple dozen more of those because it's mostly takes place in this virtual world, and Mamoru Hosoda is really focusing in on just sort of the variety of characters that live in this world, and they just sort of float around in a cloud. They don't do anything.
I know.
You just sort of, and they leave comments on other people. Like, the actual mechanics of this doesn't make a lot of sense.
They're not.
And when we're in there, it's just a big visual cacophony.
It's things, and it bothers me because it's. Mamoru Hosoda, I mean, he made Digimon, which I haven't watched. I know a lot of people love Digimon. It's a big deal. I haven't watched Digimon. I'm sorry. I know that his film Summer Wars is very Digimon-esque, and I know it's very inspired by stories he wanted to tell in Digimon, and he's telling them in a different way. But my introduction to Mamoru Hosoda is in the film Summer Wars. Movie's over 10 years old now. Summer Wars, and I'm bringing this up because it connects to Belle. Summer Wars, it also takes place, it's semi-futuristic. There is a new social media network, which is basically the whole internet of the entire planet. Everything is interconnected here. The movie takes place at a family reunion, and a guy has been asked to impersonate a young girl's boyfriend because her grandmother is probably dying. She's very, very old, and she just wants to be able to say to her grandmother, "See, you don't have to worry about me. I found love." So he agrees to impersonate a boyfriend for a weekend. It's already awkward. But wouldn't you know it, also that weekend, an artificially intelligent virus infects the internet.
Oh, jeez.
And it's going to destroy the entire planet. And somehow it all connects to everything going on at this extended family reunion. That sounds like a weird premise, but Mamoru Hosoda so expertly equates online life, online interconnectivity, with having an extended family. That all of a sudden, this extremely abstract, broad, and very problematic concept that we have of the internet feels intimate and human. And that's something that he struggles with here, because this movie takes place so much online and involves so many mechanics which are poorly explained or explored that the allegory gets really lost after a while.
Yeah,
or they're going pure allegory when I still have legitimate mechanical questions that are completely distracting.
Mm.
And the way that the story kind of evolves and moves away from a very pure and simple setup and gets kind of stuck in the weeds of this fairy tale conceit, which is pretty clunkily added on halfway into the movie, I don't quite buy it. And I don't really buy the relationships that build in this internet world. And I think this movie really, really struggles. I think there's interesting stuff here. It's not a complete watch, but I think this movie really struggles to find its footing. And it's the only Mamoru Hosoda film I've ever seen that just doesn't feel sure of itself.
And it's not just the technical stuff. I feel like a lot of the social and moral ethical questions aren't really well thought out either.
Yeah.
This is, without revealing too much about the plot, this is a movie where an abusive parent can be deprogrammed with a stern look.
That's naive.
It's incredibly naive. Yeah. And in fact, its view of the internet in 2022 is also incredibly naive. This idea that we can connect with each other now. Yeah, no shit. That's 25 years ago.
Yeah.
We've learned sort of like the horrible trenches and the dark corners of the internet and what kind of damage it can do.
Yeah.
Trying to tell a story about if we have a more advanced version of it, it'll be better again somehow.
See, that's the thing. Summer Wars 10 years ago told a story about this, about how the internet can be weaponized and we can lose track of it. And at the end of that movie, when the internet actually is able to briefly come together and do something as a globe. It feels nearly impossible, and it feels earned, and it feels rare, and you know this isn't going to be the norm, but it means that much more.
Yeah.
That it was possible to do the right thing on the internet, and he knows how difficult it is. Here, it seems like he doesn't know how difficult it is.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like he's arguing it should be easier. Maybe it should be. Yeah, it should be. But it loses its connection to a reality. It ceases to function as a meaningful allegory and ends up at best becoming, as you said, an after-school special about serious issues that are overly, and he handles them in an overly reductive way.
Way oversimplified.
Like in a way that makes them useless.
There are certain conceits, like certain dark things that happen in the real world, you know, with death and abuse and harming other people.
Yeah.
And those are fine things to make movies about, especially if we're going to actually confront those things. But some of those things can be used so much that they become movie cliches, and they become weaponized as cheap plot points. A character getting cancer, for instance.
Sure.
Getting cancer in the real world is a tough thing.
It's a horrible thing, and it's a real thing.
And it's something that it's okay to tell a story about and have an experience about. But it happens so often in movies that when, you know, stepmom steps forward and says it, it's like, okay, this is dumb now.
It's being used not...
It's
being used in replace of genuine drama.
Yeah.
It's basically, I'm going to remind you of something that involves genuine drama that probably, depending on who you are and how long you've been on this earth, you've had some experience with this personally, and you can just sort of substitute that in, and I don't need, the filmmaker, I don't need to actually do the work anymore.
Yeah,
I can just say the C word, and now all of a sudden you know someone who died from that or something, and it's like, okay, great.
Now this is meaningful. It's
actually lazy, shitty writing, and it's really reductive to the human experience. You actually, every single time you do something like that, you still have to do the work.
So when certain things come up, certain very real dramatic things, I you know, in the theater, I sound like a jerk for laughing at it.
Yeah.
But I am also an experienced enough film watcher to understand how cynical it is to use that as a plot point.
You're chuckling, and it's not cool, actually. But like, you know, but you're chuckling. Well, you're chuckling because you're not invested in the narrative. Mm. You're only looking at it from the perspective of someone who knows how films are made.
Mm.
And I was hearing a story Peter Bogdanovich wrote about where he went to a screening of the movie The Trial. With Orson Welles. Orson Welles directed an adaptation of this Kafka story, The Trial, Kafka wrote a story about a guy who is on trial and he's not even sure for what. Like, that's how Kafka-esque this Kafka story is. And the whole thing is that Orson Welles explained to Pedro Almodovar, like, nobody knows that movie's supposed to be funny. Hmm. Like, everyone's like, oh, how serious and dramatic. I said, no, it's absurdist how fucked up the bureaucracy is. Like, you're supposed to be able, like, it's so oppressive that it's funny, and people aren't letting themselves laugh at it. So they talk about a scene where they both go to a screening of the trial, and they are laughing, and everyone in the theater is mad at Orson Welles because he doesn't get the film. Because Orson Welles knows, like, no, I'm looking at the form here. The fact that everything, the world keeps shitting on Anthony Perkins in that movie, is supposed to be funny after a while. Mm. You have to have some sense of how the movie is being perceived. Anyway, Bell, I don't want to write it off entirely because there's too much interesting craft in it.
I brought that up because there is something in this film that feels it feels like a cheap shot.
Yeah.
It's this really cheap way to manufacture drama without actually dealing with it in a real world sort of way.
Yeah, I agree.
Or exploring the actual complexity and emotions and horrors that go into the thing that it brought up.
Yeah.
And instead says that
it's pretty easy.
It offers this really oversimplified, technologically based solution, essentially arguing that it can easily be solved. And
that's just irresponsible.
That rubs me the wrong way.
I think it's irresponsible. It's not practical. It's not plausible. It's something that people at home can't really use.
Yeah.
That's the problem. It's like, it's maybe the situation is different, but when a movie is dealing in, because again, this is kind of a take on Beauty and the Beast. It's a fable. It deals with a certain form of, maybe not narrative simplicity because he's making it overly complicated, but certainly a form of emotional simplicity. Hmm. That needs to connect in such a way that people in the audience can do something with it. There's nothing really it can do with Belle. I appreciate what I think it starts off really strong. I think the idea of basically taking this Ready Player One virtual world and talking about how this is a place where introverts, artists who feel like they've lost connection to their craft can have like a fresh start and they can like find a new identity for themselves. And we can talk about the nature of that identity. There's a subplot, which really doesn't go very far, about how because the protagonist really idolizes this other girl in her class who seems like she's super popular and got it all together, that her avatar, Belle, looks like her.
Yeah.
Like, actually looks more like her friend at school than it does like her. So much more you could have done with that. Like,
they don't even address that.
They barely address that, like, at all. They forget about it after a while. There's so much, before the Beast thing comes along, this is so much more interesting and so much more engaging, and the allegory is actually really effective. And then once the Beast comes along, it just gets distracted. And I know that this is like, This is the telling of Beauty and the Beast. That's where this came from. But there's an expression in screenwriting called kill your darlings, where sometimes the reason why you started writing something is the thing holding it back. Once you start developing it more, you realize that there's something else about it that is more important or interesting or cohesive, and the whole reason that you were there in the first place no longer fits in the story that you're telling. I'm not so egomaniacal that I would tell Mamoru Hosoda that that's what's going on here.
How to make his movie.
But it feels like it. It feels like the Beauty and the Beast thing that is the reason why we're here is holding back all the stuff that isn't that. Because that actual stuff is clunky. Mm. And it doesn't really fit in the framework of everything else that we're telling very well. So this is a bummer. I'm trying to say disappointment because I don't like to like come up with the idea like, oh, Mamoru Hosoda's got a new movie, it's going to be brilliant. Well, I had high hopes because I love his movies.
It's fair to make certain assumptions about
assumptions.
Well, when the film starts, you have to put whatever assumptions you have aside and let the film say what it has to say.
When you have a filmmaker whose work you love, you hope that the next one you'll love too. But you have to deal with what it is. And what this one is... It's his worst movie so far, honestly. It's not particularly good, unfortunately.
Like I said, I haven't seen his other movies. Maybe I'll have some sort of toxic reaction to The Boy and the Beast.
Mm. That's one of my favorite movies about fatherhood. That movie makes me cry like nobody's business.
Like I said, I do really like Mirai, and I think Wolf Children is perfectly sweet. Okay. There's a sequence near the beginning where they're just fixing up a house. Yeah. It's nothing to do with wolves at all. It's just getting the house ready for living in that is some of the better animation I've seen, just in terms of texture and timing and changing just and lovely. Just the beauty of it all. Very, very good director. But yeah, there's just...
This is a mess.
It feels way too adolescent. It feels like they're not thinking stuff out. Yeah. It's just not a good movie.
Yeah, it's a bummer. Well, anyway, let's review some movies on the critically acclaimed scale. Once again, we review movies on a scale of C- to C+. The lowest score a movie can get is a C-, that is below average. That's everything from, we didn't like it, to the worst movie ever made. Most movies would get somewhere around a C. That's some good, some bad. Maybe it's a recommendation for a very specific audience, but generally speaking, not that great. C, average. Mm. Above average is a C+. And that means we either recommend it or think it's the best movie ever made or somewhere in the middle. it's really, really good, is what we're saying. On that scale, Whitney, what do you give Belle?
I give Belle a C-. Some cool creative visuals, but it's not enough to recommend. It's not so dazzling that I think you should go in just for the visual stuff.
Yeah, I dislike having to give this a C- just because I'm such a fan, but this is a high C-. I do think there's some good animation in here, and there's some good ideas in there somewhere, but none of them come together terribly well, and it's a real bummer. This is a C-. Hotel Transylvania 4, Transformania.
Also a C-. Not enough comedy. Like I said, a few clever bits. I'm just reminded of the scene where the vampire bat, in order to evade being in sunlight, has to hide behind things that are sort of falling through the air, and one of the monsters has to throw its own severed head, and it's like hiding behind the severed head as it flies through the air. I thought that was kind of a
there's some
visual dynamism to that, but... Mm. Ultimately, at the end of the day, it's not terribly funny, and it's not as energetic as the other one, so it's a little bit of a letdown.
Yeah, it's a big C- for me as well. The premise of the plot is fine, but then, much like Belle, it doesn't do anything with it. It ends up going off in another direction that we didn't need the good setup to get to, and then once we're there, it's not good. And Belle wasn't supposed to be funny, but Hotel Transylvania is trying to make a lot of jokes, and... I laughed twice. That's not a good... That's a really bad ratio. And again, even the third one, which is really disposable, I laughed a lot. This one's a bummer. Then finally, Scream. The new Scream. Whitney.
The new Scream. I also give a C-. This is just a big old goose egg of a week. I feel like there's just not enough energy, not enough wit, not enough originality to... what could be done with a series that sort of lives and dies by its commentary on where horror is. And I feel like this could have delved far deeper. It could have dispensed with a lot of the soap opera stuff. It could have had a little bit more fun with its kills, maybe a little bit more brutality. There's plenty of blood, but more in there. get some severed hands and rubber arms and knives in the eye, you know, really, really gory stuff.
Saw at that point. All right. Well, for me, it's a big old C+.
Oh, golly.
I like this Scream a lot. I think this movie understands that Scream has to serve a lot of different things at once. It needs to be a whodunit. It needs to be a slasher. It needs to be violent. It needs to be funny. It needs to have a soap opera element. It needs to be an ensemble drama. It needs to be a lot of different things at once. And I think it handles that balance really, really well. I cared about the new cast more than I've cared about the new cast of any Scream since Scream.
Okay.
I really was more invested in who lived and who died. And when they died, and it was like really, really fucked up some of the deaths, like not necessarily because they were like, you know, elaborate, but just because they were slow and sad and painful. It meant more to me. Okay. So I think this is a very, very strong entry in Scream. And I really like it a lot. And, sometimes Whitney and I disagree. Doesn't mean one of us is wrong. Maybe.
Except William's wrong.
Except Whitney's wrong. But that is it. That is it for Critically Acclaimed this week. I have no idea what's coming out next week. Did you look and see what's coming out next week?
I'm seeing a Danish film. I have a screener for one of those. It's with Nikolaj Coster-Waldau. It's called A Taste of Hunger. We'll be reviewing that next week.
Oh, that's fun.
Maybe it's the week after.
It's two nights.
That's one I get to write about. I'm doing an interview. My first interview in quite some time.
That's so cool with him.
It's coming up with Nikolai Coster-Waldau.
That's cool, man. I didn't know about
Star of Gods of Egypt, so I'm definitely asking him about that.
Yeah, neat. Looks like it's a relatively slower week. Mm-hmm. We've got movies called Redeeming Love, The King's Daughter, and The Royal Treatment, and maybe a few others, and we'll take a look.
We'll get to something.
There'll be movies. But anyway, thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for joining us. Please subscribe if you haven't already. We have a Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, where we have a lot of exclusive shows. You can also vote for future episodes of our show, Critically Reclaimed. Thank you to every single one of our patrons, without whom this show would not exist. Mm-hmm. This show would not be even remotely possible without our patrons. So just thank you so much to everyone for all your support. Whether you're new or you've been supporting us throughout the years, you mean the world to us. And we hope you're enjoying the exclusive shows over there. We got shows dedicated to Batman, Star Trek. We got commentary tracks. We got a lot going on over there, and we just hope you enjoy it. If you want to, share your voice, you want to ask us some questions or share your commentary, anything we discussed in this episode or anything at all, our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Once again, that is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We might read your email on an upcoming episode of We've Got Mail. If you would prefer to send us snail mail, just full of snails.
Send us snails. No, send us an actual physical letter.
Yeah,
we have a P.O. box. Send it to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
We would love to hear from you. We're also on Twitter, @CriticAcclaim. I am @William Bibbiani.
I'm @Whitney Seibold.
And that's it for this week. Never forget, everyone's a critic, including you.
I want to go to the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?